Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, your technology-enhanced podcast from the tech team here at The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week we're joined by a very special guest.
You have much more physical interplay with the game experience, which makes you feel like you're inside the game, not outside the game. I wanted people to really feel that when they threw an object, it would have an effect.
Hollywood Goliath Steven Spielberg speaks with Bobby about his transition between the big screen to the small screen. The movie giant's second computer game is out soon, and we find out if he's planning on turning his camera in for a controller on this week's show. So Bobby Johnson, that is, you join us down the line. Where are you that you have to speak down a line?
I am currently en route home in Las Vegas. I've been trekking around the deserts of southwestern America for the last few days, so just on my way back.
What were your top three things that you saw on the way?
Oh man, it's unbelievable. I've seen so much stuff the last few days. Grand Canyon is amazing, Monument Valley, and I went to a meteor crater as well.
I love meteor crater.
Which was like 2.5 miles in circumference. That was pretty incredible as well. So always
worth the stop on those trips across the states. Meteor crater is really incredible. Charles.
Hello.
Charles,
and as
Arthur.
All the emails I get from people I've never met say, I hope you are well.
Are you well?
I am well, actually. Though I'd never let the email correspondent know.
Well, this week, in addition to speaking with Steven Spielberg, we're talking transport. We're looking at the technologies that get us to and fro, from the chips that give us accurate bus times to the mobile phones that feed back about traffic jams on the motorway. We'll be dissecting this week's top stories, hearing your feedback, and more. Keep listening for the most stimulating 30 minutes of your life, or your money back. Last year, Steven Spielberg left the director's chair to take on a whole new adventure, computer game design. The celebrated film director partnered with Electronic Arts to produce Boom Blocks, a game for the Nintendo Wii that was a cross between virtual baseball and board game Jenga. And as an aside, I recently had hurt my shoulder when Boom Blocks came out, and I think I injured it even more by playing Boom Blocks, because you have to chuck and throw and get quite... Anyway, although it didn't get particularly rave reviews, it was clearly successful enough that the director-publisher duo are set to release the follow-up, Boom Blocks Bash Party, in the next coming weeks. Bobby spoke with the movie director over the phone last week and began by asking him when his love affair with games started.
Well, I was playing video games before I ever had a family. Back in 1976, when I was making Jaws, I played the first Pong game that was installed on Martha's Vineyard. And so I played video games 10 years before my first child was born. That's why it's very easy for me to switch back and forth from motion picture development to game development.
So most people in Hollywood either see games as a threat, if you're not in the cinema because you're out playing a game at home, then that's a big problem. Or they see it as a marketing opportunity, a chance to push through a franchise. I'm just wondering, you seem to be coming from somewhere different.
No, I'd be a hypocrite if I thought that the gaming business was hurting the movie business, because I go out to movies and I play games. I used to go out to play games until games, came to us. I developed GameWorks in conjunction with Sega, and we had them in about 16 venues around the world, and that was very successful until the home platforms began to sell like hotcakes, and then all the video game parlors went the way of the dodo bird, and now we're all playing at home, and someday we'll be playing directly on our TV sets, bypassing all of the platforms.
Boom Blocks is a Wii game that makes use of those features. I wondered, is there something that's particularly interesting to you about the Wii, or are you in general platform agnostic?
I'm a PC game player more than anything else, but I also play on Xbox and 360 and PS3. And I get more into the micro physics of gaming, especially when I'm on the PC. I'm closer to the screen. I look for detail. I notice things more easily. The Wii platform, which I adore, is more of a macro experience, you know. You look at the overview, you know, you're standing back from it. You have to stand back from it. The screen is usually smaller as you step away from it, but you have much more physical interplay with the game experience, which makes you feel like you're inside the game, not outside the game. And that's why I wanted to develop Boom Blocks for, you know, the Wii platform, because I wanted people to really feel that when they threw an object, it would have an effect.
Lots of people in Hollywood just don't get games, and equally lots of people in games don't really get Hollywood. Do you consider yourself a campaigner to kind of bring the two closer together?
Look, for years people played bridge, they played poker, you know, they went over to each other's houses to play rummy tiles. Families played Monopoly together in Candyland still. The technological aspect of the gaming industry, it's a kissing cousin, you know, to games that we've been playing, parlor games we've been playing for hundreds of years.
How closely are you actually involved in the development of the games that you work on? I mean, is it just that you're, at the beginning, you're the ideas man who gets things started or starts them moving along?
No, I work right along with all the game developers right along. You know, I don't think a week has gone by where we haven't met. Unless I'm on location or out of town, I'm over at EA at least on an average of once a week. And I'm very interactive with all the developers on the whole Boom Blocks project.
So what's the one thing that you would like to do in gaming that you know, you haven't seen or you haven't done yet? What's your dream?
In the short term, I would love to start seeing 3D games being developed where with a good pair of glasses, you know, we get a real three-dimensional experience in front of an appropriate monitor that is designed just for 3D, because, you know, 3D hasn't quite been perfected to carry over onto just any monitor. And after that, we'll certainly be virtual reality, which, just like 3D that came and went in the 1950s, and now it's here to stay in movies. I really think virtual reality, which experimentally came and went in the 80s, is going to be redeveloped just like 3D is being redeveloped today, and that's going to be the new platform for our gaming future.
That was Steven Spielberg talking about his love affair with gaming. So, Bobby, is virtual reality the technology of the future, or is Spielberg blinded by the lights on his sets?
I think it would be a brave person who said that virtual reality is going to be the future. It's probably true. You know, I think something like Second Life is akin to virtual reality, and, you know, we'll see new iterations of this come along. I thought it was interesting, the stuff about 3D gaming that he mentioned, because as we've talked about in the past, I think 3D gaming is something that, even if it doesn't prove massively successful, is certainly something that people are going to be pushing for, because it's a kind of new way to experience games. But I thought overall, I was fairly impressed when I talked to him about, you know, he wasn't just a name that was being slapped on the boxes of games. You know, he genuinely seemed interested in what was going on.
But at the same time, his movies have particular themes. You know, they talk about the family, they talk about identity and fear of change and fear of growing older. You know, they can, even if on the surface they seem quite superficial, they do tend to deal with quite deep subjects. But Boom Blocks, there's not a single deep thought in there as far as I'm concerned. Do you think that choice is a result of the technological limitations, or do you think he views this technology as something that's very different than storytelling?
Yeah, I certainly think there is an element of an approach by kind of traditional Hollywood folk, a few people who have moved kind of sideways. And what they're really interested in is more of the, you know, the entertainment aspect of games, you know, the kind of pick it up for 5 minutes, play it, put it back down again. And the communal aspect of playing games with other people, which by their very nature tend to be things that don't have particularly deep stories. You know, they're more like party games, which is certainly what Boom Blocks comes under. You know, there's nothing to prove from Spielberg in telling stories, in computer games.
So while there have been some people who've crossed over, generally movies and games have not been a particularly well-matched pair, unless you consider the generally subpar games that have been bolted onto releases of films. What other things do you think make good crossovers between the two?
I remember back in the days when, you know, you'd play Batman, which came out at the same time as the first Tim Burton movie, and it was, you know, that kind of raft of terrible platform games that were on the Spectrum and the C64 that just were horrible kind of attempts to market. This is what Spielberg started, really. Spielberg and Lucas with, you know, the Indiana Jones and Star Wars, this whole kind of franchise movie idea. The big push comes from the gaming industry now. You look at Grand Theft Auto and, you know, that's a very cinematic game. You look at BioShock or even, you know, even something like Halo. We know Peter Jackson's been involved in trying to make a movie version of that. The momentum is with the gaming industry now. It's growing faster than Hollywood. It's a kind of really, really appealing blockbuster breeding ground. And I think that's why we might start to see more crossover in a more interesting way, because we'll be looking at the interactive side of it and developing that more than simply, you know, bolting on a brand onto a pretty generic game.
Well, I personally am looking forward to that. I think that the potential for crossover is huge. When you have the audiences who are watching films and the audience who are watching games, you can imagine that film franchises could potentially change with the course of the plot lines of games moving back into the film. But that's just one of my fantasies. Final note from Twitter. Wowzer says about Spielberg and gaming, and this is one for the geeks and all of us, whatever you do, don't mention that E.T. game. And of course, that E.T. game is the Atari 2600 version of E.T., which has been rumored to prop up quite a bit of sand in the New Mexico desert. So yes, buried deeply under Area 54. 51? 54. Anyway, we'll move on. Catch up on Boomblock Bash Party on the Games blog and on the Guardian's Games page, which is guardian.co.uk/technology/games. And now it's time for the news.
Wolfram Alpha, a web search tool that could take on Google, was released to the public on Monday. The site acts like a giant calculator processing data and trying to link up facts to present as results, rather than a list of sites which may contain the answer. This type of semantic search is in its infancy, but is likely to increase in importance and use as more pages are written in a way that allow them to reference each other. Pressure from US officials has forced classified advertising website Craigslist to pull the shutters down on its controversial sex adverts in favour of a new, closely monitored system. In an announcement earlier this week, Craigslist chief executive Jim Buckmaster said the site would be closing the erotic services category next week. The site will instead open a new adult services category in which every advert will be manually approved by staff before it's seen by members of the public. French file sharers will be targeted by the police after politicians voted for a controversial three strikes law that could see alleged copyright infringers disconnected from the web without legal recourse. A bill was approved last week after a concerted push by Nicolas Sarkozy's Conservative government, and it's expected to be passed into law by the Senate later this week. The bill will create a new government agency which will oversee what have been called the world's tightest copyright restrictions.
Wolfram's Alpha, Charles, you've had a go at it, you've played around with it. Why are people so interested? There have been so many other search engines that have been bubbling and rumors about being Google killers and all that. What is it about Wolfram's Alpha that's actually garnering so much press and potential?
To some extent, it is sort of human curated, but more interesting is that it's semantic, that it really does try to understand, in the computer's sort of sense of understand, what it is that you're asking. So often you'll find that if you pose a question in one way, it says, Wolfram Alpha doesn't know what to make of your output. But if you pose it in a different way, as people have been finding, then you will get a useful answer. And it tends to be a precise answer, and it tends to be one that actually makes sense straight away. There's no messing around saying, well, let's see, there's 497,000 links. I wonder if the answer is going to be in sort of number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Bobby, I wanted to drag you in here kicking and screaming. What do you see as the future of search? Briefly, I mean, I thought search was local, not this big idea of everybody contributing to it.
Wolfram Alpha, they don't like calling themselves a search engine, and I think it's much more akin to a kind of encyclopedia. It was interesting last week at Google's Searchology event, they started talking about semantics, and actually got quite defensive about the idea of the semantic web. They don't like the idea that everyone's going to be producing semantic web pages, although they are going to start supporting microformats, RDFA, things like that. I think that the question is really how you make money from that. Wolfram Alpha's benefit is that it's from a relatively small company whose biggest product is called Mathematica, and that's it's the kind of computational engine that Wolfram Alpha's built on. They're a competitor who are coming out of a different channel. They're not Yahoo, they're not Microsoft, they're not trying to replicate Google, they're trying to do something different.
Let's move on now to the three strikes ruling in France. Charles, can you tell us what that ruling was?
Basically, it's that if people have been found to have been pirating material and have received three warnings, then they get cut off. And it's something that has been mooted for a fair while. Nicolas Sarkozy has been behind it, pushing it very hard. It's now been passed. So the question becomes one of whether it's going to have a significant effect on piracy.
Bobby, do you think it's going to work?
Well, I think the biggest challenge might come from Europe, actually, because the European Parliament recently voted to say that actually without a court being involved at that point might be considered an infringement of your rights, there's no due process. So I think actually, it might prove to backfire really, and the French government might spend a lot of money trying to implement a law which gets crushed at a European level. So it'd be interesting to see where it goes. It could go anyway, really.
What do you think is going to happen in terms of UK regulation with this as a precedent, Charles?
Well, Lord Mandelson has already said today at the Google Zeitgeist event that he doesn't expect to be doing regulation of the internet in the UK, which broadly seems to suggest that the ISPs have won out, that the content lobby has not won in terms of trying to get the government to implement something. Even though a year ago the government was saying, come on, you guys, we're going to bang heads together. If you don't have a law in play, if you don't figure it out between yourselves, we're going to implement the law. That all seems to have gone rather quiet.
Well, you can read up on all these news stories on guardian.co.uk/technology.
Going on the roads this evening, so let me give you an update on the motorway situation first of all. The M62 is still closed both ways, 28 and 27, Tingley and Gildersham.
How many times have you heard that, only to find that it's led you right into traffic? Yes, the accuracy of traffic news is notoriously patchy, so how are the traffic controllers working to make it right? Tech Weekly took to the streets to find out about the new services responsible for getting you from A to B.
This weekend we'll see a rush for the coastlines and for tourist destinations across the UK. But for the unlucky, it will mean time sat on a platform or trapped in a car waiting to start the bank holiday break. But the popularity of technologies like the mobile web and GPS is making these scenes an avoidable annoyance for those who know how to connect up to the latest travel info. SatNav is an amazing technology in itself, but TomTom have developed a service which has turned their devices into live connected machines, which can get you around traffic problems without you knowing. TomTom's Chief Technology Officer, Mark Gretton, explains more about their live service for SatNavs.
Anyone who's used these knows that the route it gives you when you know an area well is not always the one you would take. So we'd, for a long time, knew that the Holy Grail, you know, was giving you a route that would tell you something you didn't know, even when you knew an area well. And we have to do a thing called dynamic routing to do that. Whenever someone uses one of our navigation devices, they're asked a question, would you like to contribute to the quality of navigation anonymously? And if you say yes to that question, we log speed and position while you're driving around. It's encrypted so no one can extract it from the device, and when you connect your device to a PC, we upload those and they get aggregated into this huge database. That database is then put back into our devices, so that when we calculate a route, you look at all the routes possible and you add up the time it will take and you take the one that's the quickest. That won't give you the best route if there's been some horrible accident on the A4 or something. So on top of that, our devices now have a SIM card in them, and we use the GSM network so that we can actually dynamically route someone to avoid specific incidents, and indeed change your route as you drive, because as you drive something may develop or clear. In fact, every single car in principle, if it can tell the server how fast it's going and where it is, can act as a traffic probe. You know, so if someone is driving at 10 miles an hour on the M1, there's a good chance that there's a problem there. And if two or three people are driving at 10 miles an hour, we know there's a jam there. So we have servers in the Vodafone network running our software, which analyzes the underlying network traffic in the Vodafone network. The amount of data there is huge, absolutely huge. And then all they output is much, much lower bandwidth data, which is simply the average speed in real time of road signals. And that goes directly over an IP link to our data center. So when you switch your device on, or when you plan a route, the device makes a request to that server for the relevant information in the area that you're planning your route.
But how does the system know that the signals are accurately monitoring traffic and that they aren't picking up, say, traffic flowing along an A road while the motorway next to it is blocked? Well, there's even an answer for that.
There are lots of rules we apply. They have to be within a certain amount of distance from a road. There are special cases where there's issues. If you have a railway line running parallel to a road, for example, that can present something. We have to make some special filters for these things. Another interesting case we've dealt with recently is the M4 leading into London. Very special case where there's a bus lane and you get people on the phone in their buses. So the speed looks okay, but of course the people that matter sitting in their cars are all stuck in a stationary traffic jam. But then there are in fact cameras on the M4 there, so we can deal with it.
On the bus and rail networks, there are other clever systems helping to keep things moving. Tim Johnson works for Kazoom, a company that deals with the data generated by public transport, and he explains how their processes work.
There are two types of data. There's timetable data and there's real-time data. So real-time data, that's data that comes from tracking the actual position of the bus. The timetable data is organised regionally around the country. There's an organisation called Travelline that organises the distribution of this data at a regional level, whereas the real-time data is organised by the local councils that have chosen to invest in those real-time schemes. It's much simpler for rail because we have this history of nationalisation, and so the systems that we have now are largely linked historically to what was devised by British Rail. And so there is a national timetable, and there's real-time data sources collected centrally there as well. So the first thing we have to do is join the feeds together, blend them, so that, for example, we understand where a bus in the timetable matches a bus that we see in the real-time feed. And once we've blended them, we have to apply sort of presentation rules to make it public-friendly, so turning some of the jargon into useful things like bus arriving in 5 minutes. Something else we do is we decorate the data with other information. So it may be that we get incident information, for example, about roadworks, from a different source.
Tim also has interesting ideas for the future, harnessing communities of passengers to provide live travel updates themselves.
I really think there's potential there that the public would be interested in data that's actually sourced from the crowd. And it could be as simple as I am here on Twitter, just the social function of saying I'm on this train, who else is on this train? But beyond that, one can imagine gathering information from people sitting on the bus or train with nothing better to do about incidents, about delays, and actually being able to provide sort of quick, not official, but potentially useful advice on what to do, possibly before the official answers start to come. Also things like crowding on trains. A lot of us go to the same station every morning at the same time of day and wonder whether it would be better 15 minutes earlier, whether they should be in the seventh carriage rather than the second. So there's things like that that are probably never going to be officially collected, but potentially could be easily collected and cheaply collected if we could think of some intelligent way of building that community and presenting the information back to it. The other topic was proactive alerting, getting information to the public at the point of decision, rather than them having to ask the question, trying to catch them at the point at which they've got a choice to make, such as when they're about to leave the house in the morning, when they're about to leave the office, especially if they have real modal choices, such that they can take the bus or the car. Using the power of mobile phone location, the system can know where you are and can make a judgment as to what you're doing. So I walk out the door in the morning at 7 o'clock, I turn left, clearly I'm going to such and such an office, and therefore trigger my alert then, tell me then whether I should be taking that train or whether I should be diverting to the bus stop.
Now what I found really interesting about that was this idea of automatic crowdsourcing, of using the cellular networks. But this automatic crowdsourcing is kind of in contrast to what Tim Johnson was saying, which is this idea of using social media in order to crowdsource information. So what do you think, Charles? Which one do you think is a better application of this kind of data for real world traffic information?
Well, actually, I've got to take the a third way, which is the free our data view, which is that actually all this data about car and vehicle movements is already available. The highways agency already collects it, at least for the principal motorways, because it has cameras on the bridges over the motorways at various points, which tells them what the traffic flow is. And they know exactly how many vehicles are flowing through at any time. And you can actually see this. There is a highways agency website which will show you this. But that is data which is collected by the highways agency. Highways agency is a government-funded agency. Therefore, it's our data. We should be able to get it for free, do things with it, like mashups. Sometimes you do see Google, which will offer you traffic predictions even, which I think is using that data. Using the cell mobile, the cellular network, great idea. Crowdsourcing, equally great idea. The problem is always the penetration. How do you get enough people to start using these applications that you get a critical mass where it becomes really useful? Because the problem that everyone knows about is that if you don't have enough information about what's happening, then it's just not worth having.
Bobby, are there any comparable services or any kind of comparable systems over in the US?
I think data of many different kinds is a lot more open and free. I think what people have learned, and it sounds like this is what's being learned in the UK as well, is getting over this difference between big infrastructure government-style projects that kind of want a new overarching way of doing stuff that makes everything work, versus a more bottom-up procedure in which you look at the data that's out there and you say, how can we more intelligently use this? And cell data is a perfect example. Somewhere in the network exists this piece of information. If we learn how to interpret it and then, as I said, embellish or augment other data with it, then suddenly you can triangulate something and come up with something that's really useful. But I think really, I think mentioning before, getting a critical mass of people to use it, there really needs to be a marketing push behind some of these ideas. Signs in places that say, if you're having a problem, text this number or say this, and that's what's always going to struggle to happen, I think.
Well, yes, and it seems that that they struggle to make the trains run on time anyway, so who knows what's going to happen in the future. You can read up on the free our data issues at guardian.co.uk/technology or go to /transport for more on the transport news across the country. Well, those blogs have been jumping this week. Bobby, what have you been reading over on tech?
I wanted to pick out a comment that came in a post that Jack wrote about Sony losing $1 billion. I thought it was interesting, mainly because there seemed to be some weird subtext to this particular comment, which was from Neuron, who, after moaning that Jack was being unfair to Sony by saying that they'd taken a battering, posited his idea of his or her idea of what Sony should do to solve the problem, said Sony should look to working with Google to create web portable devices and integrate its products. The console market for the future does look increasingly high risk for them at Sony. They may need a partnership with some unwelcome companies. I just like the idea of the unwelcome companies. It kind of made me think of Tony Soprano knocking on the door or something. You know, we must come up with a partnership with you, and you can't say anything about it.
I actually like the idea of a giant Google game. So if they do work with Sony, then they've got a couple of good designers under their belt. So possibly. Well, speaking of games, over on the games blog, Keith asked a Friday question last week. He wanted to find out what readers wanted from games, what more things readers wanted. Funnily enough, nobody said more Spielberg. But, you know, there you
more
go.
More E.T.
Nobody said more E.T.
More like E.T. 20 on the Atari 2600.
We gave him a shovel and sent them to New Mexico. There were some inspiring suggestions, however. Quite a few people wanted more humor. Some people wanted voice commands, so this idea of sort of interacting, using your voice. There was a brilliant game back on the Sega Dreamcast that had voice commands. It was called Seaman, and it was really, really weird. And then other people wanted new approaches in storytelling, so clearly that's a place that Spielberg could slot himself in. But Chubster 2010, he wanted to see more nature sims. In particular, he said, more fish and lions, please. Mm. So in that Seaman was a fish. Maybe we could have a voice fish storytelling nature sim fusion. Well, I personally would like to agree with Krispy Krum.
Is Krispy Krum a fish finger?
It could be, actually. Sponsored by Fish Fingers R Us. And he says, more zombies, you just can't have too many, which I heartily agree with. You really can't have too many. Charles, what have you been looking at over on technology?
Well, the Wolfram Alpha blog post, I did got a fair amount of commentary on it. But I've got to say that I think Quinn Parker has hacked to the heart of the system. There were people who were asking Wolfram Alpha, you know, what is the answer to life, the universe and everything. But Quinn Parker got right down to back to basics with what is the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow? Works very well indeed.
Excellent. I can only imagine the quotes that would be going into there. On the email, which seems, with all these Twitters and Facebooks and yada yadas, to be quite an antiquated technology, some people do still use it, and they do get in touch at tech@guardian.co.uk. JT, John Tippins, says he enjoyed the latest edition, which included an interview with Spotify's UK MD. However, he says, I was surprised that he seemed hesitant to release any figures relating to users and listeners. They recently, at his company, received an email with one of their sales reps. This is Spotify sales reps really bigging up their latest figures. So he's not really sure why Spotify was so shy. And it turns out 1 million unique active users. So why they weren't celebrating that, who knows. Don't forget to check out our photos over on the Guardian Tech Weekly Pool on Flickr, and do feel free to add some of your own. Today's photos include what Scott sees, our producer sees. I went into the booth. Yes, I cheekily popped into the booth when nobody was looking and took a photo so you can find out the kinds of technology that we play with in this studio, and it's a very fabulous studio. Also, send in your favorite street technology, from computerized billboards to bus stop updates to geeks wearing Arduino boards. Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about when I say Arduino boards, you can find out in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, find out how you can get in touch with us on our website.
In this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, we find out what it's like to answer AQA questions and how hard it is to get near the minimum wage doing it. Yahoo's mobile question answering service and Amazon's Mechanical Turk seem like you're getting questions answered by an invisible intelligence. You are, but if there's any human intelligence involved, it's paid peanuts, if that. As the mobile application and games market grows rapidly, is it the saviour of either industries? And we hear how Real DVD justifies itself as a decision is imminent in the case of the film studios versus Real Network's DVD ripping program. It's all in this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
That's your lot for this week. But if you want a live Tech Weekly experience and you can get to Bristol for the weekend, join Jemima and Scott for drinks and nibbles and a live recording at the Watershed at 4 p.m. To the rest of you, and to me, I'm afraid, I'll hear the results next Tuesday. So thanks very much for doing that, guys. Thanks also to our guests, Steven Spielberg, Tim Johnson, Mark Gretton, and thanks to our team, Bobby Johnson, Charles Arthur. I'm Alex Kratosky, and we'll see you next Tuesday. We'll